to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Tuesday, February 2nd. I'm your reader, Kathleen. From the front page of the Gazette today, fishing licenses jump after years of decline. This story's by Aaron Jordan. Iowa sold 24% more fishing licenses in 2020, boosting state revenue and reversing what had been a downward trend in the pastime over the last decade. Fishing enthusiasts say they hope increased interest in fishing during the COVID-19 pandemic will continue as Iowans discover or rediscover how casting a line and waiting for fish to bite can be good for mental health. "It's very relaxing," said Gary Smart, age 66, of Marion, who was a member of the Cedar Rapids Bassmasters. "There's nobody out there bothering you. Even in tournaments, there are days you don't catch nothing. But you're out here anyway, you're away. You can't get much more socially distant than sitting on a frozen lake ice fishing." That's what Kyle Burrows, age 37, of Fairfax, did last week in Palo with his brother-in-law, Neil Aubert. "I've been having good luck these last couple of weeks," Burrows said. The men use an auger to cut a hole through the ice, then drop in a sensor that uses sonar to find underwater structures, such as humps, rocks, fallen trees, or drop-offs where crappies like to hide. If they find a good spot, they fish there. If not, they move on. "The electronics and technology these days, you know if they are there or not," he said. Burrows and Smart noticed the increase in anglers last summer when boat ramps were bustling, sporting goods stores were picked over, and it took months to order a new boat. The Department of Natural Resources sold 439,531 resident and non-resident fishing licenses in the 2020 licensing year, which went from December 15, 2019 to January 10, 2021. This is up more than 84,000 licenses from the previous licensing period. The increase isn't unexpected. COVID-19 has caused more people to seek outdoor activities of all kinds, but it follows a long-standing decline in interest in fishing. The Gazette reported in May 2019, Iowa fishing licenses had fallen 14.5% from 2009 to 2018. While 2009 was a big year for fishing because of the economic recession, 2020 had 18,600 more licenses than 2009. Alex Cross, DNR Customer Service and Licensing Supervisor, said in 2019 the downward trend was because families had so many activities, including kids' sports and travel, competing for their leisure time. But with camps canceled and vacations scaled back in 2020, more Iowans found time for fishing. Cross said he didn't know whether the trend will continue in 2021. "We certainly hope that anglers will continue to partake in the activity and purchase fishing licenses," Cross said last week. However, it's hard to predict due to the future of the pandemic, weather, and other factors. "We work hard internally through the R3 initiatives, recruit, retain, reactivate, to provide outreach to current, future, and lapsed anglers." Fees, licenses, and permits made up 17% of the DNR's $378.4 million budget in fiscal 2020. Fishing and hunting license revenue were $37.4 million in license year 2020, up $3.6 million or 11% from 2019. An unexpected boost in fishing and hunting licenses helps the DNR stock more fish in lakes and ponds, restore more habitat, and make more improvements to state parks, Smart said. It also helps the state's economy. "It generates revenue that trickles down all the way," he said. "More people are fishing, more people are buying equipment. It's jobs, it's money, all the way around." In another front page story today, UK virus strain found in Iowa. This story is by Aaron Jordan. Three cases of a new, more contagious variant of COVID-19 have been confirmed in Iowa, with two of these cases in Johnson County, the Iowa Department of Public Health confirmed Monday. The SARS-CoV-2 B117 variant, often referred to as the UK variant because it was first found in the United Kingdom, spreads more easily than the original strain. However, COVID-19 vaccines now being deployed in Iowa are considered effective against it. Two cases of the UK variant were identified in Johnson County, one in an adult identified as between the ages of 18 and 40, and another in an adult between 41 and 60. Another adult case was in Bremer County in northeast Iowa. IDPH and local public health have already initiated contact with these cases to understand their exposures and initiate the health monitoring process, state public health officials said in a news release Monday. The process will include notifying anyone with whom these individuals have been in close contact. The individuals will be advised to isolate in accordance with IDPH and CDC guidance. Public health officials do not believe the three Iowans with the UK variant caught the virus from one another. The three strains have other mutations that would indicate that they did not acquire it from each other or the same source, public health spokesman Sarah Ekstrand said in an email Monday night. The new strain was confirmed Monday morning at the State Hygienic Lab in Coralville. The lab has been participating in the CDC's SARS-CoV-2 strain surveillance program by sending COVID-19 test samples to be sequenced for the B.1.1.7 variant since early December, the state reported. Lab staff recently began doing their own internal sequencing to look specifically for the variant. Routine analysis of genetic sequence data assisted in identifying the new variant strain in Iowa. The lab sets a goal of sequencing 45 positive samples per week, selecting a specific virus mutation identified by the polymerase chain reaction test, the public health department said. It is a variable number because not every sample has sufficient RNA to sequence. Another 19 samples every 2 weeks go to the CDC. The Association of Public Health Laboratories, of which the State Hygienic Lab is a member, reported on its website participating labs are requested to provide specimens that ideally represent a variety of demographic and clinical characteristics and geographic locations, which will ensure a representative set of sequences are generated for national monitoring. Dr. Caitlin Padotti, state medical director and epidemiologist, said in a prepared statement, virus mutations are expected. Sometimes new variants emerge and disappear, she said. Other times new variants emerge and persist. Multiple variants of the virus that causes COVID-19 have been documented in the United States and globally during this pandemic. Other COVID-19 variants include B.1.351, first identified in South Africa, and P.1, identified in travelers from Brazil, the CDC reported. Updates to Iowa's B.1.1.7 cases will be shared on the CDC's website. These case counts only represent the variant strains that are confirmed through genomic sequencing and may not accurately reflect the true number of variant cases. Mitigation efforts that slow the spread of COVID-19 include wearing a mask or face covering, practicing social distancing with those outside your household, cleaning your hands frequently with soap and water, staying home if you're sick, getting tested if you are exposed to or have symptoms of COVID-19, and getting a COVID-19 vaccine when it's available to you. Moving to the Iowa Today page, the UIHC starts taking names for those wanting the vaccine. Hospital warns doses are limited and a long wait is possible. This story is by Vanessa Miller. University of Iowa Healthcare on Monday morning officially began collecting names of community members wanting a COVID-19 vaccine, propelling the hospital system into its next vaccination phase after the campus, following state guidance, vaccinated its thousands of hospital and clinic employees. The campus is keeping back enough vaccine to ensure all its workers receive the two required doses of either the Pfizer or Moderna vaccine. But UIHC last month received permission from the Iowa Department of Public Health to start administering community doses in February. Community members as of Monday can sign up for the vaccine dose via the MyChart electronic medical record system or through a website portal for those who don't use MyChart. Once you complete the form, please do not call us according to instructions on the UIHC COVID-19 or COVID vaccine website. When you are eligible according to the state's criteria and we have doses available, we'll contact you via MyChart or by phone to schedule your appointment, the website advises. The state's top priority group, who've been getting vaccines since mid-December, includes healthcare workers and those in long-term care facilities. Iowa's vaccination phase 1B started Monday and includes people over age 65, first responders, pre-K to 12 educators, frontline food and agricultural workers, government officials like those at the state capitol, and correctional facility staff. Although vaccine is limited and UIHC hasn't disclosed how many doses it has for its community vaccination program, the campus has laid out a three-step process for those wanting to sign up. First, let the campus know via MyChart or an online questionnaire that asks for name, gender, birth date, phone number, email address, residential address, and whether the individual is a UIHC patient. Second, wait for notification from UIHC, quote, that you are eligible to schedule a vaccine appointment, end quote. And third, accept the appointment through a phone or MyChart to confirm the date, time, and location of your vaccination. The UIHC website warns the system is not first come, first served. As doses become available, we will use a random selection process to choose the names from those who are eligible. UIHC also is urging those who don't live in Johnson County to check with their home county's health department for alternatives. UIHC officials have warned that because doses are limited, the wait for a vaccine appointment could be long, even for people who are currently eligible. We are as eager to give you the vaccine as you are to receive it. UIHC on Monday was reporting 9,185 employees have received at least one dose, and 7,144 have received both the first and second. In Johnson County as a whole, 21,714 doses have been administered, with 6,889 people receiving both their first and second shots. Linn County has administered 19,424 total, with 4,308 people completing the two shots. Also on the Iowa Today page, Freebie February gives thousands of vouchers for attractions in Cedar Rapids. The Cedar Rapids Tourism Office and Greater Cedar Rapids Community Foundation are offering a limited number of free admission vouchers for some Cedar Rapids attractions as part of Freebie February, according to a news release. People can sign up for free tickets for the African American Museum of Iowa, Hawkeye Downs, Bruce Moore, Cedar Rapids Museum of Art, National Czech and Slovak Museum and Library, Indian Creek Nature Center, I'm on Ice Arena, Theater Cedar Rapids, and the History Center at Tourism. The number of vouchers for each attraction varies from 125 to 900. They do not necessarily need to be used in February. The program also will include support for future live events at Nubo City Market. These organizations are a critical part of our community, said Les Garner, the president and chief executive officer of the Greater Cedar Rapids Community Foundation. And for that website, go to cedarrapids.com/free-admission. Also on the Iowa Today page, Linn County Auditor considers run for Secretary of State. This story is by Gage Miskeman. Linn County Auditor Joel Miller has announced he's exploring a run for Iowa Secretary of State. In a blog post over the weekend, Miller wrote that he has created the Miller for Iowa Secretary of State Exploratory Committee in an effort to unseat Secretary of State Paul Pate. Pate, a Republican, was reelected in 2018 after gaining the seat for a second time in 2014. He held the office from 1995 to 1999. Miller, a Democrat, told the Gazette on Monday he decided to explore a possible campaign because, he said, Iowa needs a Secretary of State, quote, who is focused on making voting easier while ensuring the integrity of elections, end quote. The voters need an advocate to keep voting simple and make voting simpler, Miller said. I know I'm not the only county auditor that feels that way, but getting a county auditor to leave their comfort zone to run for statewide office may be a bridge too far if the Democratic Party cannot broaden their appeal in rural Iowa. If no one steps forward, then maybe I'll run if it feels right. For now, I'm exploring. In his blog post, Miller said the purpose of his exploratory committee is to recruit a current or former county auditor to run for Secretary of State in 2022 or to run for Secretary of State myself. Frankly, I don't know if anyone other than a Republican can win another statewide office in Iowa. Is there another Tom Miller, Michael Fitzgerald, or Rob Sand out there? He wrote, referring to the Democratic Attorney General, State Treasurer, and State Auditor, respectively. Miller told the Gazette he is skeptical Iowa Democrats can win more elections in 2022 than they did in 2020. In 2020, Democrats running for the legislature did poorly and lost ground, he said. It's clear to me that the Iowa Democratic Party's message in 2020 did not produce results. I have my doubts that the Democratic Party can turn things around in time to win in 2022. Miller added that if he does run for the statewide office, he will transfer funds raised by the exploratory committee into his campaign account. If he doesn't run, he said, he will transfer the funds to the Iowa Democratic Party. I'm not going to self-fund my campaign, Miller said Monday. Mike Bloomberg tried that and lost. I need lots of donations from a variety of people. I need accurate data to determine whether the people of Iowa are satisfied with the status quo, the incumbent or whoever becomes the Republican candidate, or do they want a Democrat in the office of Secretary of State? Pate, a state senator from 1989 to 1995 and mayor of Cedar Rapids from 2002 to 2006, and Miller, Linn County's auditor since 2007, have had public feuds in the past. The latest was last summer when Pate blocked Miller and other Iowa County auditors from mailing absentee ballot request forms to registered voters with partial voter information already filled in. In August, a judge ruled in favor of a GOP lawsuit about the absentee ballot request forms mailed by Miller, effectively invalidating around 50,000 of them. Additionally, Miller set up ballot drop boxes at grocery stores, which Pate said were illegal. Ultimately, Miller was allowed to set up ballot drop boxes on county property only. To date, no one has announced they will run for Iowa Secretary of State in 2022. And in another Iowa Today story, a trial is reset for a Cedar Rapids man accused of killing his girlfriend and unborn child. This story is by Trish Mahaffey. The trial for a Cedar Rapids man charged in the fatal shooting of his pregnant girlfriend and causing the death of her unborn child and with attempting to kill another woman has been reset for September 13. Johnny Osborne IV, age 26, is charged with first-degree murder, termination of pregnancy during a forcible felony, attempted murder, and willful injury. He is accused of fatally shooting his girlfriend, Asia T. Grice, age 25, who was in her second trimester of her pregnancy on May 1, 2020. She died from a gunshot wound to her head. Her unborn child did not survive, according to a complaint. Police responded to reports of shots being fired about 4:39 a.m. at 1610 30th Street Northwest, apartment 11. They found Grice's body and Grice's friend, Keona Smith, who was seriously wounded. Smith said Grice and Osborne had been temporarily staying with her for about a month, a criminal complaint and search warrant affidavit stated. Smith said she was in bed when she heard a loud bang in the living room where Grice and Osborne were staying. Osborne opened her bedroom door and shot at her multiple times with a silver revolver, according to court documents. Osborne left the apartment and Smith tried to call for help but couldn't operate a phone due to her injuries. Someone else called police. Smith told police she had seen the revolver hidden in her couch before the shooting and believed it belonged to Grice or Osborne. A woman who spoke to police said she learned of the shooting and went to the Roadway Inn, 4011 16th Avenue Southwest, where she had rented a room for Osborne's brother, Javante Osborne, age 20. She went to his room, found Johnny Osborne was inside, and notified police. Police found the brothers at the motel and brought them in for questioning. Javante Osborne said he had been at a friend's that evening and that his brother had picked him up around 6 a.m. May 1. Officers checked surveillance footage from the motel, and it showed the brothers returning at 4:57 a.m. Smith had told police Johnny Osborne was from Tennessee, and they obtained Osborne's Tennessee driver's license. Another witness told police she called her son for a ride about 12:30 a.m. and that he arrived with two men, the affidavit stated. One she knew was Johnny and the other as Big Dog Keto, as Javante Osborne identifies himself on social media. After two stops, she told police, they went to a parking lot behind Smith's building, and she watched the Osborne brothers walk toward the apartment building before leaving. Grice's sister, Victoria McDaniel of Joliet, Illinois, told the Gazette a few days after the slaying that Johnny Osborne was controlling, jealous, and possessive. Grice never admitted it, but McDaniel suspected he physically abused her. McDaniel said after meeting Osborne last year, she thought something felt off about him. Her sister was different when he was with her, like he drained her of her light, the sister said. McDaniel said Grice, who worked in assisted living and was studying to be a certified nursing assistant, had just put down a deposit on her own place. She believed that's why her sister was killed, because she had a new plan for her life. Moving now to the Insight page, the guest column today, spending our stimulus. Giving away money can be difficult. It's a dilemma we learned when we received our recent economic stimulus check. We don't need the cash. Although our working salaries were modest, for decades we spent sparingly, avoided debt, saved and invested money, and emerged hardly wealthy but easily able to pay our bills. We're fortunate. Too many good people, especially those who clean buildings, tend the elderly, wait tables, and clerk in stores, do essential tasks, yet are inadequately paid and often lack benefits. Coronavirus and the derecho added to their financial and emotional stress. When we learned we'd each received a stimulus payment, we decided to get it into the hands of people caught in a financial crack, that is, we hope, temporary. The $1,200 we received from the government isn't a lot of money, but it just might give people a shred of financial breathing room to pay rent or buy groceries. Deciding how to get money to people in need is challenging. Giving to big national charities would be simple, but we wanted to channel our stimulus cash to local families and achieve maximum benefit, so we did it in two ways. First, we sent some of the money to three local nonprofits that directly help people. They are the Catherine McCauley Center, which provides services to immigrants and refugees transitioning to life in Iowa, the local chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, which helps families challenged by mental illness, and Family Promise, which helps families meet temporary basic needs, such as paying rent and buying food. Secondly, we knew several people who suffered income losses caused by the pandemic, so some of our stimulus money went directly to a hairdresser and massage therapist. We hope it helps them financially squeeze through until their business recovers. Our stimulus money is thin when spread among these vital groups and people. We challenge others who don't need their stimulus to join us helping local people. Together, we can make an enormous difference in the lives of families caught in financial binds. And that was submitted today by Marion and Rich Patterson, co-owners of Winding Pathways, LLC, a business designed to encourage people to create wondrous yards. And their website is windingpaths.com. One community letter to read today. Two education bills are wrong for Iowa. Senate File 159 passed in the Iowa Senate on January 28th, sending it to the House immediately. If passed, public money will be diverted to non-public schools. There is no rationale for the action. School boards, administrators, educators, and the majority of Iowans didn't ask for it. Campaigns didn't mention vouchers to the public during the 2020 Iowa House and Senate campaign. Who wanted it? Special interests wanted it. It's wrong for Iowa. Senate File 160 passed through both Iowa Senate and House in one day, and the governor signed it afterward in a process taking about a week. SF 160 cuts to the heart of Iowa school boards' local control, a sacred concept in Iowa for decades. It supersedes the board's responsibility and usurps its authority by placing it in the governor's office and the Department of Education. It is now law. It's wrong for Iowa. This isn't about Iowa's students or public education system or supporting school boards, administrators, or educators. It's about appeasing special interests. Once again, public education is a pawn in a political chess game. The intention was to move them quickly before most of the public could react. Special interests to public education, zero. It's wrong for Iowa. And that is signed by Pat Shipley from Nottoway. And the guest column today is submitted by David Krugler, and it's a quiz, Black History in the United States. Since 1976, when President Gerald Ford designated February as Black History Month, every U.S. president has designated February as Black History Month, with the inauguration of the United States' first African-American vice president. The quiz below from the Ashbrook Center at Ashland University provides you the opportunity to test your knowledge of African Americans who served our nation as we mark this unusual and annual observation. Number one, an estimated 9,000 Black patriots fought against the British in the Revolutionary War. Even before the war began, Black patriots Crispus Attucks is considered a hero for his efforts during what event? And rather than read through all of the options, I'm just going to give you the answers to these quizzes. The answer to number one is C, the Boston Massacre. Number two, which famous abolitionist was the first confirmed for a presidential appointment by the Senate? And the answer is Frederick Douglass. Number three, who was the first African-American governor and what state did he serve? And the answer is A, P.B.S. Pinchback of Louisiana. Question four, the first two African-American U.S. senators represented which state? And the answer is Mississippi. Number five, African-American volunteers made up which of the following famous World War II military units? And the answer, the Tuskegee Airmen. Number six, which African-American co-founded the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party? And the answer is Fannie Lou Hamer. Number seven, who was the first African-American woman elected to Congress? And that was Shirley Chisholm. Number eight, who successfully argued the landmark desegregation case, Brown versus Board of Education, before the U.S. Supreme Court and later served as the first African-American justice of the court? And the answer is Thurgood Marshall. Number nine, who was the first African-American to serve as U.S. Secretary of State? And that was Colin Powell. And finally, number 10, how many African-American women were elected or re-elected to serve in Congress in 2020? And that answer is 26. David Krugler submitted this, and he is a member of the Ashbrook Center faculty, professor of history at the University of Wisconsin, Platteville. He writes for InsideSources.com. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Tuesday, February 2nd on IRIS. And now we turn to today's obituaries. In the short notices from Center Point, Joseph William Cook, age 84, died Saturday, January 30th. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Marion. In Dorchester, Norbert L. Cruz, age 79, died Thursday, January 28th. Martin Grau Funeral Home, Waukon. In Highlandville, Fred Gerleman, age 63, died Sunday, January 31st. Schluter Ballack Funeral Home, Decorah. In Independence, Frank A. Hovey, age 83, died Saturday, January 30th. Reef Family Center in Independence is assisting. In Marengo, Nicholas, known as Nick J. Dye, age 37, died Thursday, January 28th. Closter Funeral Home, Marengo. Also in Marengo, Leland Lortz, age 88, died Sunday, January 31st. Closter Funeral Home, Marengo. From Miles, James House, age 82, died Friday, January 29th. Carson Celebration of Life Center, Maquoketa. In Monmouth, Doris Eyrig, age 87, died Monday, February 1st. Carson Celebration of Life Center, Maquoketa. In Preston, Wayne Nolting, age 88, died Sunday, January 31st. Carson Celebration of Life Center, Maquoketa. In Tama, Winifred Elizabeth Haney, age 62, died Sunday, January 31st. Cruz Phillips Funeral Home, Tama, Toledo. And in West Liberty, Viola Winifred Wilkie Cook, age 102, died Sunday, January 31st. Fry Funeral Home, Tipton. Moving to the regular notices, Daryl L. Tim from Marion, age 91, passed away Friday, January 29th at the Solon Care Center. The family will greet friends from 4 to 7 Friday, February 5th at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Marion. Funeral services will be at 10 a.m. Saturday, February 6th at the funeral home conducted by the Reverend Becky High. Burial will follow at Springville Cemetery in Springville with military honors provided by Springville American Legion Post 331 and Iowa Military Funeral Honors. A live stream of the funeral service may be accessed on the funeral home website page for Daryl starting at 10 a.m. Saturday, February 6th. The Murdoch Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements for Daniel Tim. In Marion also, Vicki D. Gent, age 67, passed away Saturday, January 30. The family will greet friends from 5 to 7 Thursday, February 4th at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion, with a scripture service beginning at 4:30. A funeral mass will be held at St. Joseph's Catholic Church in Marion, officiated by Father David O'Connor. A live stream of the mass may be accessed on YouTube. Burial will take place at 12:30 p.m. Friday, February 5th at St. Patrick's Cemetery, Little Creek, southeast of North English, Iowa. In Keokuk, Paul William Kerfman died Saturday, January 30th at the Great River Medical Center in West Burlington, Iowa. He was a veteran of the U.S. Army and proudly served from 1955 to 1957. Graveside services with military rites will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday at St. Patrick's Cemetery, St. Patrick, Missouri, with Father Rob Fields officiating. There will be no visitation. Memorials can be made to the Great River Medical Center Intensive Care Unit in West Burlington, Iowa. Online condolences can be made to the family at www.vigenmemorialhome.com. Vigen Memorial Home in Keokuk, Iowa, is assisting the family with arrangements. In Cedar Rapids, Corey Klatt, age 47, passed away on January 24th. A private viewing was held for his children, and a private celebration of life for family will be held at a later date. Online condolences may be left at iowacremation.com under obituaries. In Marion, L. Marie Ann Meyer, age 96, passed away Saturday, January 23rd at Terrace Glen Village, Cedar Rapids, and will be interred next to her husband in Cypress, California. The family will hold a private memorial at a later date. For more information, please call 913-206-3026. And in lieu of flowers, donations may be made to Bethany Lutheran Church in Cedar Rapids. In Marion, Betty Ann Hiltbrunner Borgensen, age 90, of Marion, passed away at her home Sunday, January 24, surrounded by family. Per Betty's wishes, there will be no services except for a graveside service for the family at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery, Cedar Memorial Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. In Anamosa, Alan Lee Serbosik, age 81, passed away January 31st at home after an 18-year battle with prostate cancer. There will be no services at this time. Al has donated his body to the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. By visiting www.getchonline.com, you may share your thoughts and memories and condolences with his family. In Garrison, John Walter Heineman, age 80, passed away Saturday, January 30, at Unity Point Health, St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. Memorial services will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, February 6th, at St. Mark Lutheran Church in Garrison, with the Reverend Stephen Preuss officiating. Visitation will be held from 9:30 a.m. until service time Saturday at the church. Memorials may be directed to Unity Point Hospice or St. Mark's Lutheran Church in care of Phillips Funeral Home, P.O. Box 307, Vinton, Iowa, 52349. In Manchester, Catherine L. Manson, age 94, passed away Sunday, January 31st. Memorial service will be held at 1 p.m. Wednesday, February 3rd at the United Methodist Church, with Pastor Phil Rogers officiating. Interment will be held at a later date. Bowen Camp Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service is assisting the family. In Coggin, David Lee Roy Dighton, age 85, passed away January 30. He was at home on the family farm surrounded by family. Family will be present at a visitation from 4 to 8 p.m. Thursday, February 4, at United Parish Church in Coggin. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. Friday, February 5 at the church, officiated by Pastor Sherry Anderson, with military rites provided by Coggin American Legion No. 36. A luncheon will follow at the Coggin American Legion Hall. You may leave a memory of Dave or a message for the family at www.murdochfuneralhome.com. In Cedar Rapids, Frances Marshall Lash, loving mother, grandmother, great-grandmother, sister, and aunt, passed away at the age of 94. In keeping with Frances' loving and generous spirit, she decided to donate her body to science in hopes others might benefit. Due to COVID-19 and for the health and safety of her community, she asked that there be no memorial service. A memorial stone will be placed in Oak Hill Cemetery on Mount Vernon Road in Cedar Rapids. Memorial donations may be made in Frances Marshall Lash's name to the Greater Cedar Rapids Community Foundation for the Marshall Journalism Incentive Fund. In Sigourney, Shirley Ann Woods, age 83, passed away January 30 at the Keokuk County Health Center in Sigourney. Private family funeral service will be held at 2 p.m. Saturday, February 6th at Powell Funeral Home in Sigourney with Pastor Vince Holman officiating. The service will also be live-streamed on the Powell Funeral Home Facebook page. Burial will be at Pleasant Grove Cemetery in Sigourney. Visitation will be from 4 to 7, Friday, February 5, at the funeral home. A general memorial fund has been established. Powell Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Sigourney is caring for Shirley and her family. In North English, Duane Harold, known as Bear or Schaefer, age 73, passed away Saturday, January 30, at the English Valley Nursing Care Center, surrounded by family. Celebration of life services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, February 3, at St. Paul Lutheran Church in Williamsburg. The service will be live-streamed on Powell Funeral Home's webpage, Facebook page, and website. Burial will be at St. John Lutheran Cemetery near Homestead. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday at Powell Funeral Home in North English. Face masks are required. Please practice social distancing. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions may be made to the North English Community Center or St. Paul Lutheran in Williamsburg. And our final obituary from Cedar Rapids, Barbara Ellen Hladek, age 82, peacefully passed on Friday, January 29, after a valiant battle with Lewy body, dementia, and diabetes. Arrangements are being handled through Cedar Memorial in Cedar Rapids. Per Barbara's wishes, no formal services are being scheduled at this time. Her family will likely plan an informal celebration of life at a later date. In lieu of flowers, please consider donations to the Cedar Valley Humane Society or Meals on Wheels. Moving to the sports page, there are no high school-related sports stories today, but here are the events of area interest. In girls basketball, at 7:30, Washington is at Prairie, Linmar is at Cedar Falls, Xavier at Dubuque Hempstead, Kennedy at Waterloo West, Liberty is at Dubuque Wallert, and Clear Creek Amana is at Marion. In boys basketball, 7:30 p.m. start, Cedar Falls is at Linmar, Dubuque Hempstead is at Xavier, and Dubuque Senior is at Iowa City West. Also in boys basketball, Marion is at Clear Creek Amana, Jefferson is at Waterloo East, and Mount Pleasant is at Regina, that game at 8 p.m. And in prep bowling, Washington is at Cedar Falls, that will be at Cadillac Lanes, and that starts at 3:15. Moving now to the community page, here are the Eastern Iowa briefs for today. From Cedar Rapids, library opens for grab-and-go services at both locations. Both locations of the Cedar Rapids Public Library now are open for grab-and-go from the stacks, in addition to curbside holds pickup. The Downtown Library and the Ladd Library will open their doors for this service Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 8 p.m., and Fridays and Saturdays from 9 to 5. Patrons and staff are required to wear a mask when inside the library. Capacity will be limited, and patrons may be asked to wait before entering. Patrons should limit their visit to 30 minutes or less, or up to 1 hour for a public computer. Children must be accompanied by an adult. No contact curbside holds pickup also is available by appointment at both locations. Patrons can make an appointment for curbside holds pickup by visiting crlibrary.org/curbsideholds and select a day and time that is available, or call 319-261-READ for assistance. Library book drops are open and items are quarantined for 72 hours before being circulated again. Additional cleaning procedures are in place throughout the facilities. Furniture has been removed and plexiglass barriers have been installed for safety of staff and patrons. Public computers are available for up to 1 hour a day, and patrons can drop in or make reservations up to 4 days in advance. Visit crlibrary.org/computers to make a reservation. Library programs continue to be provided virtually. Visit crlibrary.org/events or the library's Facebook page for virtual programming. And Orchestra Iowa cancels the rest of the season due to COVID-19. Because of the ever-changing circumstances related to COVID-19, Orchestra Iowa has decided to cancel all remaining performances for the 2020-2021 season. The following performances have been canceled: Spring in the Air, scheduled for March 12 to 14. The Creation, March 27. Carmina Burana, April 17th and 18th. Guitar Heroes, May 8th. And Inspiration, May 22 to 23. We are anxious to celebrate with our community once again and hope that a return to Bruce Moore in September will be the right opportunity to emerge from the silence this year, said Jeffrey Collier, Chief Executive Officer for Orchestra Iowa. All questions can be directed to the Orchestra Iowa ticket office at 319-366-8203 or tickets@orchestraiowa.org. Once again, that number is 319-366-8203. And finally, learn how to monitor bald eagle nests at a workshop. The Iowa Department of Natural Resources will host 2 live online training workshops for anyone interested in becoming a volunteer bald eagle nest monitor in Iowa. Prospective nest monitors must attend one of the 2 scheduled workshops. The workshops will be held via Zoom from 10 a.m. to noon, February 20th, and from 6:30 to 8:30, February 22nd. Community science volunteers have been helping to monitor Iowa's eagle population since 2006. Workshop participants will learn about this program and how to get involved and monitor a nest in their area. Iowa has more than 400 active bald eagle nests across the state, plus many more that have an unknown status. In 2020, volunteer nest monitors collected data on roughly 250 of these nests. Bald eagle nest monitors will need binoculars and preferably a spotting scope. Nest monitors are particularly needed in Alamakee, Clayton, Delaware, Floyd, Green, Guthrie, Henry, Jones, Lucas, and Winnesheek counties, but interested people anywhere in the state are welcome, with the goal of being matched with a nest near their home base. The time commitment for conducting the survey and submitting data is roughly 6 hours total between March and July each year and will require multiple visits to a nest. Each workshop will be limited to 20 households and a $5 fee is required. Registration will close at 5 p.m. February 17 or whenever the limit of 20 households per workshop has been reached. For more information and to register, go to iowadnr.gov/VWMP or email vwmp@dnr.iowa.gov. Also from the community page, Ready for a New Act. This is by Diana Nolan. 40 years ago, after its 1981 founding, Riverside Theater is entering a new stage that promises to bring new life and new adventures in Iowa City's pedestrian mall district. And pardon me, I should start that over. 40 years after its 1981 founding. When the pandemic shut down in-person entertainment and revenue streams in mid-March, it didn't make sense for the professional troupe to keep paying rent on a space it couldn't use, so Riverside closed its intimate Gilbert Street stage at the end of June. But an idea already had been planted for a possible new home in a Ped Mall redevelopment project not far from where downtown Iowa City once had a second-floor opera house. If all goes according to plan, Riverside Theater could open its new doors early next year in the revamped, refurbished, and reimagined site of the former Union Bar, 121 East College Street, across from Film Scene's original complex. Known as the Crescent Block Building, it's also near the Weatherdance Fountain, site of many outdoor concerts and dances, and a short walk south of the Englert Theater. When venues reopen after COVID close downs, the area will be hopping. I love the idea that we're going to be across the street from Film Scene and that we're going to be closer to the Englert. We're also on the same street as UNESCO City of Literature and the Iowa City Public Library. It's almost creating, solidifying what is already becoming an arts district in Iowa City, said Adam Knight, age 41, of Iowa City Riverside Theater's producing artistic director. So, the idea that you can see a matinee at Riverside, catch a film at Film Scene, while getting a great dinner in Iowa City is really exciting to be a part of. As reported earlier in the Gazette, Riverside's new home is part of a $54 million revitalization project in that area. Since 2017, Tailwind Group, based in Mankato, Minnesota, has purchased all the buildings from 109 to 127 East College Street for historic preservation and renovation. That whole block has kind of been dead, apart from some key shops like Revival and bars, Knight said. Adding this cultural space is an important part of redeveloping that whole area. There used to be an opera house on the corner of the block where Midwest One Bank is, and it was on the second and third floor. I love the idea that we are almost reviving this tradition of having a theater above the street. Riverside Theater will have a presence on three floors of its new space and the lobby and box office on the first floor. Dressing rooms will be on the first and second floors and a green room, kitchenette, and conference room also on the second floor. The third floor will house a flexible stage configuration with seating for 150, up from 118 seats at the Gilbert Street site. An elevator will make all three floors accessible for actors and audience members with mobility issues. Accessibility was always a concern for us, Knight added, and he's thrilled that the new space will do away with those barriers. Flexibility in staging also is a big plus. Building on the reconfigurations Riverside had started doing at the former site in 2019, by seating audiences in front and behind the playing space, Feast, creating a theater in the round type of experience, then building out into the seating area for a modified thrust staging with Men on Boats. The lobby itself will be almost as big as the stage, Knight said. The expanded space not only offers Riverside new ways to engage with audiences before and after shows, including post-show music and receptions, but rental opportunities for other groups, as well as cabarets or opera on tap, when Riverside doesn't have shows on stage. We're thinking of that area as a gathering space, he said. It's going to have a great view of the Ped Mall from those windows, making our theater more than just a place that you rush into to see a play and leave as soon as the show's over. Riverside also will be able to expand its season beyond the current 6-show season plus 2 summer shows. Now there's the possibility to have several lanes of programming, he said. The definition of what it means to be a Riverside patron is going to be expanded, as well as what it means to be a Riverside artist. But this all comes with a price tag that's still being worked out as a partnership between Riverside and the developer, including a rental fee that Knight said will encourage growth for Riverside Theater, while still being sustainable. Riverside's first capital campaign in 20 years is also in the works. Being able to do all this during a pandemic is inspirational, he said, with an eye clearly focused on the future. When do you get to do this? When do you get to have a theater built to your specification that fits the vision of where theater's going? If you look at our strategic plan, this checks so many boxes. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette on IRIS. I've been your reader, Kathleen. You can access today's reading online at iowaradioreading.org. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
People's Pharmacy Health Headlines. With half a dozen measles outbreaks currently underway in the U.S., as well as several serious international outbreaks, the news on measles vaccine from Denmark is important. Researchers conducted a nationwide study that included everyone born between 1999 and 2010. With more than 650,000 children in that group, they had more than 5 million person-years of follow-up. The Danish health system keeps excellent records on all of its citizens, including the children. Consequently, the scientists are confident that the 6,517 children diagnosed with autism during the study period are all the children who developed this condition. Children who did not receive the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, or MMR, were equally likely as vaccinated children to develop autism. The investigators conclude, the study strongly supports that MMR vaccination does not increase the risk for autism, does not trigger autism in susceptible children, and is not associated with clustering of autism cases after vaccination.
The Food and Drug Administration has just approved a completely new type of antidepressant. The nasal spray, called esketamine, is expected to help people who have not responded to standard antidepressants. It will be marketed under the brand name Spravato. This drug is chemically related to the injectable anesthetic ketamine that's been on the market since 1970 and is available generically. Although esketamine is administered as a nasal spray, people will not be permitted to purchase it for home use. They will need to use Spravato under medical supervision at a clinic or doctor's office. Some experts have challenged the FDA's approval process for esketamine. While two clinical trials demonstrated some benefit, two others did not show that esketamine is better than placebo. Side effects of this novel antidepressant include nausea, dizziness, headache, and a feeling of dissociation.
FDA Commissioner Dr. Scott Gottlieb unexpectedly announced his departure from the agency this week. Experts were puzzled by his announcement since he has received high marks from the administration, industry, and even some consumer groups. Dr. Gottlieb has raised questions about teen vaping and has been an outspoken critic of pharmacy chains that sell tobacco products to minors. Some commentators speculate that these stances might be related to his abrupt departure. His explanation for the sudden departure is that he wants to spend more time with his wife and young children. Dr. Gottlieb is a survivor of Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Another week, another drug recall. Many lots of ARB blood pressure drugs, including losartan, valsartan, and irbesartan, have been recalled over the past 8 months. These medicines were contaminated with potential carcinogens known as NDMA and NDEA. Now, Hetero Labs has recalled 87 lots, and Tarrant Pharmaceuticals Limited is recalling 100 lots of losartan tablets. These pills contain an entirely new contaminant just identified as NMBA. It, too, is a suspected carcinogen. All three of these nitrosamine contaminants are apparently created as a result of the manufacturing process. FDA Commissioner Gottlieb stated, "We're making important strides at understanding how these impurities form, and we're continuing to examine if nitrosamine impurities may also arise during the manufacture of other ARB drug products. The FDA is committed to implementing measures to prevent the formation of these impurities during drug manufacturing processes in the future."
Cocoa flavonoids may have some benefit for people with multiple sclerosis, according to a small study. Previous research showed that dark chocolate rich in cocoa compounds might improve symptoms of chronic fatigue. The investigators recruited 40 people with relapsing remitting MS to drink cocoa every day for 6 weeks. 19 of them got high flavonoid cocoa, while 21 drank low flavonoid cocoa. At the end of the study, those on the high flavonoid cocoa had slightly less fatigue and could walk somewhat farther in 6 minutes than they had at the outset. They also reported less pain. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.